You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
When somebody leaves, or when, you know, when you lose something, there's just such a tendency to numb it or fill that hole. There's always this hole that's created, you know, from where you're used to doing this thing, or you're used to seeing this person, or you're smelling that perfume, or you're used to hearing that, you know, sound of voice, or, you know, if you're trying to quit drugs or alcohol, you're used to having a drink at this time every day, you know, and now you don't have it anymore. And it just feels like there's nothing. And so the tendency is to try to put something in there, just anything really, like just to not feel it. And yet there's just this idea that if we can somehow sit with our own space, our own pain enough to feel it, actually get transformed. Like if we can come to know it's, and it's a sloppy process. It's not like some thing where you just like sit on a meditation pillow for, you know, 30 days straight and you did it. It's like, you know, it's a hard process, but it's just basically broad strokes saying, if we're willing to sit with those things that we feel, we can actually transform them and be a different kind of person in the world. But if we don't, the tendency is to say that didn't work because of her, because she was unhealthy, or she was greedy, or she, you know, I don't know, only ever made tuna sandwiches and I don't like tuna. And that's a sign that, you know, we shouldn't be together, or that's a ridiculous example. But just the idea that we find it easiest to point fingers at someone else than to look at what our part is in things. And what I hoped to do with that TEDx talk for my part was to make the connection between how we do that on a small heartbreak level, that we tend to not look at our own selves or take inventory of what we've seen or what we might have brought to the table, but we blame. And then how we do that on a macro level, that instead of taking time to sit with who we are, what our own sin patterns are, if you want to call it that, or what our own false self patterns are, what our own, just what we're afraid of, you know, just the ways that we've been wounded, like the tendency to then go out and project that onto someone else or wound someone else. Is really high. There's just high likelihood that we're going to do that to someone else. I know Richard Rohr has this phrase that, you know, if we don't transform our pain, we will transmit it to other people. So it was just trying to get at that concept, I think, from different points of view.
Welcome to the Deconstructionist Podcast. I'm your host, John Williamson, and I'm excited this week because, as you guys who have been listening for a while know, I'm a huge music fan. And so anytime I have the opportunity to talk to a musician and kind of pick their brains about where their inspirations kind of come from and that sort of thing, it's always fun for me. So this week, I had a couple guys on, a couple fellas. The band is called Ryan Hood. And they are comprised of Cameron Hood and Ryan David Green. And they're just amazing musicians. But on top of that, they have a lot of different eclectic influences that, you know, you'll hear us talk about in the episode. And both of them have very different kind of unique things that they bring to the table. They also have a really interesting TEDx talk that I'll put the link for in the show notes, where they cover some of those topics. And they're a couple deep guys, so it was a lot of fun to talk about music and talk about the things that inspire them and influence them. But yeah, they've been at it for a little while now, and quite a few albums out there that you can check out. And they've toured with a lot of other really cool artists like Jason Mraz, American Authors, bands like that. So a lot of fun, a lot of fun. So hopefully you guys enjoy this episode and the music as well. So as usual, I will update the Spotify playlist for those of you who are following that, and we'll add a track probably featured on this episode. So check that out. If you like what we're doing here, appreciate it. If you could, help by spreading it by word of mouth, that's the biggest way that we've gained new listeners over the years, is just by somebody telling a friend who they think might benefit from it. So, tell a friend, leave us a 5-star review on iTunes is a huge help as well. If you want to support us, we do have a Patreon, and you can find that on our website, www.thedeconstructionists.com. And we also have a web store there too. So if you want to pick up a cool pint glass or t-shirt or coffee mug, got all that there. We've got a blog that you can check out there, and you can link to us on social media and say, hey. And again, the Patreon link is on there as well. So got a couple different package deals, including a monthly book club that is pretty popular. So anyway, hopefully you guys enjoy this episode. And without further ado, I give you Ryan Hood. All right. Welcome to the Deconstructionist Podcast. I'm so excited to have these two gentlemen on. We have been trying so hard to get the two of you on. I've got the band Ryan Hood joining me today, rather, on the podcast. So thank you guys for joining the podcast today to talk about all sorts of fun things.
It is a pleasure. Thank you, John.
Yep. Absolutely. To be here with you, man.
Well, before we get too deep, because you guys aren't just like your normal everyday band. You guys go definitely very, very deep. I watched your TEDx video and loved it. I was like, man, you don't just get a concert here. You kind of get a little therapy too. So I was definitely digging that. But before we get into that, though, you guys have been making music for a while now. So when did you guys get started? And because there's two of you, I should probably do a much better job this time around of directing questions to one or the other. So let's start with Cameron. Cameron, tell us a little bit about how you guys got your music career started, and then we'll go over to Ryan.
Sure thing. Well, I'm Cameron Hood. And this is my longtime friend and collaborator, Ryan David Green. We knew each other in high school when we were in rival rock bands at our small little high school, always sort of battling at the Battle of the Bands to be like the cool band at the school. And eventually just kind of the tension softened between us, and we kind of admitted to each other that we had a lot of admiration for each other. And so what once was just this rivalry, it's like you end up being like, my rival is like me. He's a guy so much like me. We became friends and started hanging out. He got me a job at a music store. And we started playing guitar together a little bit. But he got into Berklee College of Music in Boston. And we're from Tucson, Arizona, which is where we're calling in from right now. But he got into Berklee, and I stayed at the University of Arizona here in Tucson. And so we have this like budding band relationship and friendship, but he moved away and went to Berklee. And so we kind of started to do like a band through the mail, actually, for a while, kind of like mailing each other ideas, emailing, sending mini discs and stuff back and forth.
Before the days of Dropbox, right?
yes, absolutely. And so we would send each other song ideas, and we each had separate bands, separate rock bands that we were in. But when we came together, it was just this easy thing, because with a rock band, it's a lot of moving parts, right? There's a lot of gear. It's heavy to carry everything, drums and amps and everything. It's also heavy to manage because you've got all these other people. It's, you know, usually 3 to 5 people that are in a band like that. And so you're everyone's emotions and everyone's opinions and that kind of thing. But when Ryan and I came together, it just was like this other guy that I respected. It was one other opinion to have to compromise with and way less gear to cart around. And I think that felt good to both of us. And so this just was our kind of our side project for a long time while we were doing other things, other more rocky, you know, more loud things. And then kind of around the end of college, both of our bands sort of came to an end. And Ryan was like, Cameron, why don't you move out to Boston? I think I know of a way that we can make a living as just acoustic musicians. And if I don't know, Ryan, if you want to, you could pick up the story there. But that's kind of how we met and started.
Yeah, well, the story was, hey, we're done with college. We can make a living as street performers here in Boston. Because I knew some musicians who were doing that. And I had been dabbling in it. He had come out and visited me in Boston a few times on school breaks. And we actually tried some subway performing then. And so that's what we did. He flew out there and we had basically earned the right to street perform at Quincy Market in Boston, which is a sort of exclusive street performer community where they actually hold auditions in the spring.
Whoa.
And sort of, there are people who sort of chase the summer season around the world. There's like, you'll get jugglers from Australia or, you know, acrobats and things like that come for these auditions. And so we were auditioning along with a lot of other variety of acts, and we successfully got a permit to street perform there. And it was that was the start of everything for us. That's where we started building audiences and learning how to get an audience, because you don't even get the privilege of starting with an audience when you're there. You're starting with, you know, a couple people sitting down eating a hot dog and shopping, and you try to turn that into an audience. And so we would watch these other performers in other sort of disciplines different from ours, but we'd watch them and learn from them in the ways in which they would corral an audience and sort of, I know there's a better word for it than manipulate an audience, but would bring this audience to this peak where they would do in their case, it would be the big tip moment. You know, they'd save their big chainsaw juggling moment for the end when they had enough people. And so we did that. We had our closing song that we would do that with. And then I would leap over to the CD table and sell CDs from that table.
I remember a really interesting thing about human nature that we learned from watching a lot of those other performers, you know, do it kind of better than we did it in the beginning. And they would do this thing where they would get a couple of people over by any way that they could. They'd just sort of call a couple people over and be like, hey, we're about to have a show. On the count of three, I need you to just cheer like I've done the most amazing trick or played the most amazing song you've ever heard in your life. I'm not going to do anything but count 1, 2, 3, but I want you to cheer. And so people would go for it, you know, and so they go 1, 2, 3, and everybody would be like, yeah, you know, just go absolutely nuts. And what it would do is that anyone else, like kind of in the nearby premises downtown or in that overall street performing area, would hear that, and that, like, you know, my medic desire would kick in that, like, I'm missing out on something. I've got to get over there where other people are having fun, you know, that would kick in. And then all of a sudden, about 1 minute later, you'd have all these other people start to trickle in and form this crowd before the person had done anything. And so we even started stealing that trick a little bit too.
We'd get
a good song like queued up. Yeah. And build a crowd that way. You know, you have to actually have something to do to keep a crowd, but that's a fun way to build a crowd to begin with.
That's so funny. That's brilliant. You know that. Yeah. So you start performing on the street, you're in Boston, and you guys have just kind of created this band between the two of you. I'm always interested though, when it comes to bands, like, how did you guys decide on the type of music you wanted to play? Like, I'm always interested to see, like, you know, obviously, I was going to say Foo Fighters. That's a terrible example, though, because it was just Dave Grohl, I think, in the beginning. But like, how do bands, determine what their sound's going to be? Like, we want to sound like this. Like, did you guys sit down and have a conscious discussion about that, or was it just something that you guys kind of fell into?
Influentially, at the time, there was sort of the overlap of our influences. When we were in high school together, we both loved all these 90s rock bands. You know, Collective Soul was a favorite band of ours, and bands like that. So this riffy rock stuff. But then there was, you know, it would go back. Beatles were a huge overlap. So we had some overlap influences. There was an album that, this was around the time, we probably formed shortly after Dave Matthews and Tim Reynolds had put out a duo album.
Oh, yeah.
And that was huge to me because I was an electric player before that, kind of exclusively, a lead electric player in the school of, you know, guys like Joe Satriani and stuff. They were my heroes. And I heard this duo record where it was a singer-songwriter, Dave Matthews, with this guy Tim Reynolds playing acoustic next to him. And it was incredible. And they're playing like arenas, and the arenas are going nuts for like the sound of this acoustic thing, you know, just a two acoustic thing. It kind of redefined it. And I've never really thought of this before, but also that was kind of the era when MTV Unplugged was really becoming a big thing too, right? You had the huge Nirvana Unplugged album. You had it just became clear that like there was kind of a magical essence to stripping music down to that. So it was appealing. And I think that idea, as Cameron mentioned, of kind of going lighter, not stylistically, but lighter, you know, gear wise and bringing acoustics out. We definitely go pretty high powered as an acoustic duo. One of the things we decided from the beginning was that we weren't going to play sitting down. We didn't want to be like, if we do the acoustic thing, we don't want to be sitting on a stool. We want to be standing up. We want to be creating a really fiery performance that kind of bucks that perception of a folk artist or a singer-songwriter. And also, the other thing I remember deciding early on was, you know, we both listened to everything, and I had, you know, really like happy music, and I also had, you know, a Nine Inch Nails record, there was a decision between us like, hey, let's, you know, we get to choose what we put out there. Let's always, let's leave people feeling better when they leave our shows than when they got there, and let's really bring some hope. So it doesn't mean that we don't sometimes write music, that we certainly go to heavy places. But yeah, when we sort of agree to present something, that I would say that's not necessarily stylistic, but that's more philosophical, I guess.
That was like an early mission statement for us. I mean, the thing I thought you were going to say when you were like, we decided that we weren't going to sit down. And the other thing we decided was we weren't going to wear cargo shorts.
You know? That was definitely a thing of the time. Yeah.
Like we just made this decision that we were always going to try to dress nicely, that we wanted to show our audiences that we took this really seriously, that we were going to make a show. And if they were willing to come into this world with us, like it would be it could be a transformative experience. I don't think we would have used those words for it yet, but we just wanted to show the audience that we took it seriously. But the real thing, the theme I think that Ryan just mentioned is really true, that we decided that we wanted to always at least leave it on hope, to be able to find hope in any situation. And I think it's been a mission statement for us the whole time. It's this idea that if you're not willing to go into the hard thing, into the hard places, you suffer from that kind of Pollyanna, almost pop music problem where it doesn't take anything seriously. It's in some other world that's not connected to so many people battle with. But if you spend all your time there and only there and don't find any way to lead people out of that or to find some pathway out of that, then you've only deconstructed, right? You haven't like built anything back. And so that was, I don't remember whose idea that was, Ryan, yours or mine in the beginning, but we've just stuck to it since then. Like, let's be willing to, you know, do this kind of path of descent thing in the shows, in the songs, in the stories that we tell, but we're not going to stay there. We have to always go down and then find there's some kind of hope or happiness on the other side, you know, that we've got to get to.
Yeah, you guys definitely don't shy away from the heavier themes, you know, within your music, even though, you know, like the music itself is beautiful. And what's remarkable to me too, I think, and I want to compliment you guys. Number one, I did notice how nicely dressed you guys were. That did stick out to me. But number two, I was like, those are some finely dressed fellas there, you know? But the music, you guys, even though it's just the two of you,
thank you.
You guys create like this, you guys create a really rich, big sound. And oftentimes I would forget as I was listening to the music that it's just the two of you playing, which is remarkable.
Thank you.
I appreciate that. That was present even in the really early days. I remember people kind of giving us a similar compliment at our earliest shows. And all I was doing was playing acoustic guitar and singing. I think Ryan brought all the extra sound even back then. Like, he was playing acoustic guitar, but he had like delay pedals and I don't even remember what else, but like you'd sing harmony and then you would add a delay pedal and sort of then start to layer things on top of that. And then I would hit my guitar. And then eventually we started adding in these little kick drum pedals called porch boards that we play with. So we're actually kind of playing a kick drum like sound with our feet. And then we added in foot tambourine that we'll play with live. So we're playing multiple percussion instruments with our feet and then singing harmony. And we both sing lead and both play leads at times and stuff. But I think back then Ryan was the first one to sort of add all that texture in, and he's always led the way.
Well, as you mentioned, we had to make a ruckus to round up that crowd. So we got used to being as big a sound as we could pretty early on.
That's great. So one of the things I noticed in kind of the little bio thing that I don't know if it's your manager or your publicist or who had sent over, she's very kind to send some information over on you guys. But one of the things that one of the notes I saw rather was that you guys do not consider yourselves a Christian band. And it was kind of a wink, wink kind of thing. Like, you should ask them because they'll talk about it. So like, we've had other musicians on before who have kind of gotten pigeonholed into that like Christian band type of thing. And we've always thought that was kind of funny, like as if there's like a Christian riff or like Christian drum beat or whatever. So like, clearly you guys have some thoughts on this. So like, Cameron, I know you're laughing at me, but what?
Yeah. I've listened to some of those episodes. You had the singer of Hawk Nelson on, and you've had Dan Hazeltine from Jars of Clay. And
yep.
I know that they both talked about the limitation of the market, that if you say that you're a Christian artist, you've severely limited the market right away.
Yes.
You know, now those people might be more apt to trust the people within that market might be more apt to trust you and buy whatever you make just because they feel like they can trust you. But so the biggest part that I've heard folks talk about is limiting the market. But I think for Ryan and I, it was just always this sense of like, we don't want to limit who we play to. Like, it's not so much that like, it's a lesser, I'm not trying to are focused on money or anything like that. But there's this great desire to be able to play and sing to everybody, you know, and make music for everybody. Because I know with myself, it's not always, and maybe not even mostly, Christian music or worship music that has reached me, you know. And so I just think about like, who has reached me? Well, Pink Floyd reached me, and the Beatles and U2 reached me. And those, none of those were found in the Christian section, but they did something to me, you know. And I don't know, Ryan, you want to jump in?
No, I think that's, I agree with that. I think it's just sort of, it's a big sort of beautiful world of art out there, you know. And I wanted to be a part of that big, beautiful world of art. And so that's how I feel, you know. And similarly, so much there's beautiful music in all the different compartments, but I didn't really want to go into a compartment.
I think, speaking personally, I know Ryan and I both have spent time leading worship at, you know, local churches, and we've done that. And I can tell you that the highest highs I've ever had musically on stage were actually leading worship, where it felt like it was truly about something way bigger than just us, or even the songs, or even the concepts, or even the music that we made. It just felt like I was able to just touch something, just above me that felt so amazing to me. Those are the highest highs, you know, that I've ever experienced. But that's not where I spend most of my life, I would say. And I know that not everybody in the world is ready to or wants to sing to worship music. I mean, there's some people who are who don't, you know, believe in a higher power, a God of any kind, and the only thing they need is help not committing suicide right now.
Right.
You know, they just need to find some kind of beauty or someone to sing, "I dare you to move. I dare you to pick yourself up off the floor." Like, that's the thing that that person needs, you know. And if that's only ever found in the Christian section or in or on Christian radio, right, you have to be casting a much wider net than that, you know. And then there's, I don't know, I guess I'm trying to say there's all people at every stage of spiritual, I don't know if progress is the right word, or just there's all different ways to speak to people. So we need bands making music for all different kinds of people. That's the main thing I'm trying to say, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. It's kind of funny because I think of bands like U2, one of the biggest bands of all time. And no matter where you stand on like whether or not you like their music or whatever, they very clearly sing about very heavy kind of theological topics, but they're not restricted to singing about only that. You know, they have a much wider palette to choose from.
Right.
You know, and I've always felt like that kind of seems like the right way to go.
Yes.
You know, like, cause then you have the freedom to talk about anything you want to talk about. Like you just said, you know, there are people out there who maybe just need to hear a message of hope just to hang on for one more day. And you have the freedom to do that, to speak to that, to be as gritty and as dark and as light and as happy as you want to be. Well, speaking of which, this is a great segue. Good job, guys. one of the songs that you guys play on your TEDx talk. Yeah. See, this magic in the air. So you guys talk about, and this one hit me pretty hard because I've learned, and I told your publicist this, I said, the podcast kind of runs itself. We've kind of realized that over doing it for 5 years, that doors just kind of opened as they're supposed to and in the right moment, and topics kind of present themselves just kind of at the right moment. And we stopped questioning that years ago and just kind of roll with it. So anyway, I'm sitting down and I'm watching your TEDx talk. And one of the first things you start talking about is this idea of a breakup, and this habit that human beings have, myself certainly included. I had just gone through a really horrible breakup when I'm watching this video, and I'm like, "Damn it!" Like, you know, it talks about like this habit that we have as human beings that we don't want to push in and feel that pain. Especially when it comes to a breakup, like a broken heart is one of the more painful things a human being can possibly go through. And our instinct is to move away from that pain, not push into it, but move away from it. And so often, as you put, much better than I'm putting it now, you try to fill that void with something else, whether it's fun or, you know, drugs or another person or whatever. And oftentimes we're not in a healthy place at that point. You know, we're just trying to fill this void as opposed to learn the lessons we need to take away and to put in the time to heal and that sort of thing. So talk about that. And then talk about the song that you wrote, around that idea.
Sure. That was an experience that ended up culminating in a song that we wrote together called "I Didn't Put Anything Into Your Place." And the idea there, you really captured the heart of it, that when somebody leaves, or when you lose something, there's just such a tendency to numb it or fill that hole. There's always this hole that's created, you know, from where you're used to doing this thing, or you're used to seeing this person, or you're smelling that perfume, or you're used to hearing that, you know, sound of voice, or, you know, if you're trying to quit drugs or alcohol, you're used to having a drink at this time every day, you know, and now you don't have it anymore. And it just feels like there's nothing. And so the tendency is to try to put something in there, just anything really, like, just to not feel it. And yet there's just this idea that if we can somehow sit with our own space, our own pain, enough to feel it, actually get transformed, Like if we can come to know, it's a sloppy process. It's not like some thing where you just like sit on a meditation pillow for, you know, 30 days straight and you did it. It's like, you know, it's a hard process, but it's just basically broad strokes saying if we're willing to sit with those things that we feel, we can actually transform them and be a different kind of person in the world. But if we don't, the tendency is to say that didn't work because of her, because she was unhealthy or she was greedy or she, you know, I don't know, only ever made tuna sandwiches and I don't like tuna. And that's a sign that, you know, we shouldn't be together, or that's a ridiculous example. But just the idea that we find it easiest to point fingers at someone else than to look at what our part is in things. And I what I hoped to do with that TEDx talk for my part was to make the connection between how we do that on a small heartbreak level, that we tend to not look at our own selves or take inventory of what we've seen or what we might've brought to the table, but we blame. And then how we do that on a macro level, that instead of taking time to sit with who we are, what our own sin patterns are, if you want to call it that, or what our own false self patterns are, what our own, just what we're afraid of, you know, just the ways that we've been wounded, like the tendency to then go out and project that onto someone else or wound someone else is really high. There's just high likelihood that we're going to do that to someone else. I know Richard Rohr has this phrase that, you know, if we don't transform our pain, we will transmit it to other people. So it was just trying to get at that concept, I think, from different points of view.
Heart is a house, you're the room that is empty. This is on me, I put you out on the street. By Valentine's Day, I was a miserable case. But I didn't put anything into your place. I didn't put anything into your place.
Yeah. Oh, and you just basically described every dating app ever at this point. Just damage just perpetuating itself in perpetuity. Like it's just, and at least in my experience, but yeah. I'm sure for someone out there, it works somewhere, but yeah, it's just,
yeah,
it's so true though. I'm a huge proponent of therapy. If you've been listening to the show for a while, I'm sure you're fully aware, because I talk about it constantly, but like, I really do think that all of us carry on something, you know, to various degrees and extremes, and all of us could probably stand to talk to somebody, you know, this third party impartial person, you know, and kind of.
I 100% agree.
Yeah, it could, for me, you know, it was learning that, you know, I really have a bad habit of seeing people at their utmost potential versus who they actually are. And so like Maya Angelou has this quote, you know, when someone shows you who they are, believe them, you know? And I'm like, oh, Maya, so wise. But like for my part though, you know, like you said, I think the big part of it was learning that I just need to sit with it for a while, you know? And one of the things that my therapist said is too often, people, you know, when they come together, and this is a very visual podcast here, but like she made this sign with her hands together, you know, almost like a prayer, you know, like you're folding your hands to pray.
Yeah.
But when one person is unhealthy, they shift the balance and they start leaning, pushing over into the other person's side instead of kind of being an equal support to one another. And I think, you know, too often when we push into another relationship before we're ready, or try to fill that void with something before it's time, before we're ready, before we've really worked on ourselves to become a whole person again, you know, we're just pushing that crap, that baggage onto someone else, you know, and it's you're starting off in an unhealthy negative at that point.
Yep. Absolutely. I think one of the things that we've tried to press into on this record lyrically is doing so. I think the overall theme of our newest record is like kind of finding space to catch our breath and see what's here, see what we're bringing to the table, see what we're bringing to the culture and to politics and all that. But some of the songs are just love songs or heartbreak songs, but they're songs about trying to examine what did I bring to this? You know, how could I have shown up differently? You know, so instead of just being like love gone wrong, you know, which is a whole genre of pop song. It's like love gone wrong, and what did I bring to that? You know, we've got the song, I Didn't Put Anything Into Your Place. Or no, it's called, that was the other one. That was called I Didn't Have the Chance. And it's just this song about, like, I didn't have the chance to tell you. I didn't have the chance to make this right or to make this relationship what it needed to be. And then at the very end of the song, he goes, I didn't have the chance because I didn't take the chance.
Oh.
And it's just a tiny little lyrical change. But in that, you have ownership. You have responsibility of saying, this was not done to me. You know, like, I'm involved. I have a part to play, a part to own, too.
Gosh, yes, that's so true. You know, hindsight being 20/20, it's like, you know, if you do take the time to sit with it and figure out, okay, what part did I play in this? Because when you're talking about human beings in general, we're talking about very complex, messy creatures, and then you factor in a relationship, there's always two sides to it. You know, no matter, it might be heavily weighted in one way, one direction or the other, but certainly there's things, you know, that both people, both parties contributed.
That's just an easy springboard into politics for me.
Mm.
But it's not one that we have to do. And we don't have that many political songs on our record. There's only one, maybe two, but just the idea of sitting with ourselves and who we're bringing into the culture, you know, making sure that we're the kind of citizen that we want the other side to be, because it's just a lot easier to point a finger over at the other side and be like, here's how they're getting it wrong.
Yeah.
But if we don't transform our pain, we will transmit it. You know, we're going to project it somewhere.
Oh, absolutely. And I think you're right. I think there's this element to, as soon as you point the finger, you know, you start to dehumanize the other side as well. And so it makes it very, very easy to disconnect from them as opposed to come together and have fruitful dialogue. Because at that point, you know, having fruitful, meaningful dialogue is nearly impossible once that happens.
Right. Absolutely. There was that whole thing from, I don't know if I could say it, Zizek, I think is how you say his name, but he talked about ideology and he talked about the movie Jaws and, like, you know, when Jaws came out, the United States was like, this is clearly a movie about communism. Like, like the shark represents the specter of communism, you know. But in Cuba, they saw the movie also and were like, this is clearly a movie about capitalism. You know, the shark represents capitalism. But the point being that we like to take our fears and compile everything around one big bad thing, in this case, a shark, you know, or one big bad politician or one big bad group or something. And typically when we're able to do that, like, we can dehumanize them or anyone that follows them. There's this thing that we're able to do and sort of go, I'm allowed to hate them because they're not really like me. They're not really human, you know?
Yeah, gosh.
Yeah, that's getting into the political weeds.
No, that's it makes me think of...
I'm not personally...
Oh, go ahead, Cameron.
Oh, sorry. I think we have like a little bit of lag with the audio. But
we do, yeah.
I just was going to say, I'm not super interested in the politics per se. I'm just really interested in, like, being healthy people. Can you just imagine if all of us took some time to do therapy like you're talking about and just know the things that we're afraid of and know the wounds that we have, rather than going and telling, you know, another side what they, you know, what they need to do. Not everyone is equal. There are real harms that have been done by certain groups more than other groups and to certain races. I'm not trying to make everything equal, but I'm just saying that when we have listened well to our own pain, our own wounds, our own stories, we become better listeners to the pain and wounds and stories of others, you know. All those conversations become easier when we've made some space to sit with what we're feeling also. So I was just saying, can you imagine what our political discourse would be like if we all had some awareness of our own wound and our own shame and our own fear that we were bringing to the table?
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Oh gosh. Yeah, you weren't kidding. And like, yeah, it just seems like, and I often blame social media for this, but I know it's much more complex than that. I just like to bash on social media because it just seems so unhealthy. And so often, like, you just see a lot of anger and a lot of shouting, you know, on social media, a lot of the different platforms. But I think once we've kind of boiled things down, these very complex issues down to taglines and just these terms, you know, whether it's conservative or progressive or liberal or whatever, now they've taken on kind of this negative connotation. It becomes very easy to just shut your ears off and then just shout those words, those terms at one another without truly listening. And you kind of, it's frustrating sometimes, you know, to sit here and watch this kind of discourse take place and wonder if we can ever truly get back to a place where we can sit at a table together and break bread and have a meaningful conversation. And so, like, from a music perspective, like, that's something that I think can bond people together, you know, much in the same way as a meal can. So how do you view your music from that sense? Like, trying to bring people together? Because obviously you write about very hot, heavy topics and very heavy themes. But how do you see your music from in that sense?
I think you said something like that music can be like a meal, and it's like everybody has to eat. Everybody has to sit at a table and have a meal. And I think it's kind of similar to, you know, when Ryan and I were still rivals in high school, you know, there was no, it's a funny way to put it. It's just, I was jealous of him, you know, in high school is what it down to. Really, really good guitar player with this really awesome band. And, you know, and I wanted to be awesome also at the same high school and everything.
We had a CD when you had a cassette.
Right. I mean, that's a big deal in high school. And we're like, look, we made a cassette. And he's like, oh, that's awesome. Here's our CD. And you're like, no. Like, they got
that. That's awesome.
But I remember he came over to a party at my house one time, and he picked up the guitar that I had kind of lying around at this, like, a high school party, you know, and he picked up the guitar, and I had this friend who was kind of like playing the role of a henchman who, like, came up to me and was like, yo, Ryan Green is at your house. Ryan Green is in your room. Ryan Green has picked up your guitar and he's tuning it. He's tuning your guitar differently. Do you want me to stop him? You know,
and that's like, and all totally the ladies are in there paying attention.
And I was like, no, let's go. You know, let's go see. Exactly. That's probably why I was jealous. You know? But I go in there and I listen to this song he was just kind of noodling around on this song that he was working on, and I was like, you know, play this song, Ryan. Like, I'd love to hear this. And he's like, oh, no, I couldn't. I'm like, come on, play it. He's like, okay, all right, I'll play it. And so he just plays, like, one of the most beautiful pieces of music that I had ever heard at 17 years old. Just this, like, almost Irish-y, like, open tuning guitar thing called Can I Do? And just this love song about falling in love with this girl. And like, you know, the key line is, can I kiss you? And so I do. It's like she answers, you know, with a nod. And so he does. And I just remember thinking, this guy is like me. This is like, and I only know that through music. He sang me his heart, and he's vulnerable enough to let sing me the song he was working on. I was like, this is exactly what I think about. This is exactly what I write about. I didn't know that the maestro, Ryan David Green, the maestro, like, you know, wrote about that and thought about that. And that just instantly bonded me to him. You know, he, my enemy is like me, you know,
just to, and to kind of connect all these thoughts that I agree with John. It's like, and how sacred I think music is as a unifier, as a, you know, it gets called the universal language. That's an amazing look at it right there. We can all sort of be moved by music, whether we even understand the lyrics or not. That's incredible. And it can change us even. But I think about that. We just had the privilege of playing a few outdoor shows to celebrate the release of our new album. And first of all, we've all been apart through the pandemic. And there's just a lot of, you know, separations, a lot of political stuff going on. And so to feel, Cameron made a comment during that show, like, around you right now are people who feel totally differently than you do, who think totally differently than you do. And basically just put out kind of a plea, like, to have grace for one another, that we're all trying to figure this out. We're all, we all have reasons, valid reasons that we have for fears. And it's just to, what I love is just that music can be a place where we all come together. I also kind of don't like social media when I think of bands that I think of any band or any artist, and how most artists used to be able to almost, that was probably their main function, was like unifying people. Hey, who loves this? Me, you know, 40,000 of us loved it. Love Bono. We're all there. Like, let's go together. We saw U2 in Boston, and at the end of, they closed with 40, and the show ends, and 10,000 people streamed out of Boston Garden singing, "How long?" Sing this song, as they streamed out into the bars of all the areas. This echoed on the street. We walked to that. It was this incredible unifying thing. And when the point with social media, the unfortunate thing is, I see people's comments lists, and you realize these fights break out, you know, on social media. It's these fights that don't break out when we're in person. You know, when we were at a U2 concert, we're at a concert, we're at our own concert, we see each other as brother and sister. We're there together. And so it is, man, it has, art in general, but music really has incredible power. And I sure hope that we can get out to where we're seeing shows together. And that's kind of that metaphorical breaking bread together, I think, in a way, is that we all look at each other and nod that, hey, I'm happy to be here too. You know, I like this too.
Yeah, I love that. I miss live shows so much for that reason. I remember many times going to see a band that I love, and you have that moment, that transcendent moment in the midst of the show, right, where you kind of lose sense of time and space, and you're just there, present in the moment, just kind of floating through the universe and just enjoying this music. And in those moments, you know, you're listening to a song that might be about heartbreak, or it might be about pain and loss. And those are, as you said, Ryan, you know, like, those are universal themes that everyone, regardless of your political views or your religious views, we all relate to that at the end of the day. Like, we've all experienced those things. And like, you know, like you said, when the two of you met, you're both sharing this beautiful moment listening to the song, and you didn't know anything about one another's political views, your religious views, or, you know, even your favorite food, but you were bonding over this mutual love of music. And yeah, I think that's so strong.
Absolutely.
So tell me, guys.
That's beautiful, Ryan. I love that.
Yeah, you see, like, you guys are poets, man. Like, so let's talk about that a little bit. I want to talk about, there's a song I was listening to earlier today off your new record, and the new record is Under the Leaves, right? Am I getting that title correct?
Yep.
So there's a song, you're going to have to tell me, I think it's the song Under the Leaves, but you have this lyric that I literally rewound this thing, or rewound it, however you do that on Spotify. I have no idea. It's not probably rewinding. It's moving the slider thing to the left. I don't know. But you have this lyric that I listened to, I'm not even kidding. Probably
seeked it.
Yes. But like, I think I listened to this lyric like 15 times just because I loved it so much, where you say, in the grayness of the raining, in the falling of the leaves, in the sadness, we are planting trees that we will not live to see. I probably butchered that a little, but you guys get the idea. I don't know who wrote that, but
that was it.
Yeah.
That was it.
That's good. Yeah. Just this idea that we are leaving a mark we're not going to be around to see, you know, and I look at life that way in so many ways, you know, when it comes to my daughter, when it comes to just anything I put out into the world, just this idea that, you know, this is temporary, but this impact is going to carry on. This ripple effect is going to continue and cascade long after I'm gone. So tell me about, what was the inspiration behind that song, and what made you write that lyric?
I think directly that was a response to this Wendell Berry poem called Manifesto, where he says things like, invest in the millennium. Like, your job is to help build rich soil that's going to last, that's going to really be rich 2,000 years after you're gone from the planet. But like, that it's that in contrast to what we're doing on social media. We're all, many of us, I think if we're honest, we all want to be some kind of influencer, you know, on social media, like leading people and helping them. Like maybe I won't speak for anyone else. I have that. My ego wants that. I just want to be some cool guy that's smart, that, you know, that's like a wise guide for everyone else. And it's the idea though, that to invest too much of myself in that, it's my worth then just goes up and down based on likes and how many people have seen, and whether the people that I want to see the thing that I posted have seen it, and whether I'm agreed with or not, you know, and whether I always say the right thing or I don't. That it's like, it's such a fast paced fight in a way. And it's just kind of saying, what if I don't play that game? What if I try to slow down and quiet my own mind a little bit and play a much longer, much different game? You know, I think that the trouble with like being in a band like ours, where we've been a band for 20 years now, is to know, are we having an impact? It's hard to know. If you're up one day on social media, you're down the next day on social media. And so if you're judging by that, you just can never really tell. But it's saying we're investing in the millennium, you know, we're like meaning we're investing in that soil. We're investing in just planting our seeds. That's all we can do is, you know, I think about things a certain way and Ryan thinks about things a certain way. We write music a certain way. We're going to plant that. That's what we have.
I love that. I've never thought of it. I'm going to start saying that on stage, you know, when we're playing to, you know, 48 people in Charlotte or ever, or 19 people on a Tuesday night, just say like, folks might seem surprised to see only 19 people, but this is all part of the plan. This is a long game here. In the year 3000, we are going to be a big deal.
And some staring.
Oh, man. So you just mentioned you guys have been around for 20 years, which is crazy because neither one of you look old enough to have been playing music that long. But for 20 years, that's a long time. And surely, obviously, your inspirations have changed over time and the things that inspire you and feed you. We talked a little bit about Zizek and Roar and folks like that. But What things inspire you now? Let me start with Ryan, I guess. And tell me a little bit about like when you're writing music, when you're sitting down with your guitar, what are the things nowadays that really kind of make you want to sit down and write?
Well, lately our roles, especially on this last album, I did much of the musical side of it and handled the production of the album as well. And Cameron did most of the lyrical side of it. So we've always had a leaning that way. Lyrics and message and metaphor and it has always been really a big love of Cameron's. And I've always been a kind of music first kind of person. I the song has to sweep me away kind of on its own melodies before I even dig into the lyrical content. So we're a good team in that sense. And this album, we leaned more heavily in those directions. I don't know how to say lean, but we sort of gave each other more power in those areas. So, and that's still kind of where I am now. I'm writing a lot, but it's very, I listen to a lot of instrumental music. But it could be, you know, let's see, currently, I mean, it ranges all over the place. I'd have to, that's the downside of not having physical CDs right now, you know, and just having this sort of Spotify thing. I have to look and see what have I listened to in the last week because I don't have anything on my desk in front of me. But there's, you know, some sort of virtuosic leaning instrumentalists that I'm huge fans of, people like Chris Thiele and Bela Fleck. I've been a fan of for a very long time. So a lot of these acoustic players, and Julian Lage is a guitarist that I love. Listening to things like that and just playing a lot of guitar and mandolin and but it's hard to tangibly. I've gone so long-winded, I lost sight of what your actual initial question was. Can you repeat your initial question so I can tie it up with a bow?
Sure. Oh, it's just what are your inspirations today when you sit down and write versus maybe because you named some great bands, by the way. Those are bands that I grew up with that you mentioned earlier, like Collective Soul and bands like that. So, who are the bands of today that you're listening to right now that are inspiring you?
Well, I'll give. Let's go. I'll get
you
really
can do a
accurate
little
here,
Spotify
and I'm going to open it up right now and tell you. You know, you mentioned Foo Fighters earlier. I actually really like the Foo Fighters. Just put out a new album called "Minutes to Midnight" or something. That's actually really good. And to go back to another '90s band, Weezer just put out a really cool album called "OK Human." That's like really special and neat. I mean. And now they're about to put out their Van Weezer album, which is going to go back to the other side of things. And it's, in a way, it loses it's like kind of concealing itself again with the hard rock side of stuff. But it, I don't want to say hard rock, with like riffs. And I just felt like the heart really kind of came through and the genuineness came through on the OK Human album in a way that was really cool. And I liked a lot. And other favorite albums lately. You know, there's a guy named Ben Cosgrove, who's a piano player we played with recently, and he just put out an instrumental piano record called The Trouble with Wilderness. And it's, I mean, this guy, what's so cool about him is that, like, I write instrumental music, but I always feel a little bit embarrassed saying, this song is about such and such, because it's instrumental, and I feel like it's, you know, people can think it's about whatever. He is, I mean, that's not the case with him. It's like, he's a real sort of nature. He travels and is a big fan of nature. And he has these songs specifically about, you know, this song is about this gorge in this city and the path of this bird across it. And I mean, it's very amazing. And then he plays the song and it's completely genuine. You know, his song's called things like The Rush of Beauty, A Sense of Order. And anyway, that's a really cool recent album of instrumental stuff. I've been listening to some bluegrass stuff. There's a guitarist named Grant Gordy who just put out a bluegrass album some other musicians. It's called Bluegrass and the Abstract Truth. That's really cool. I like McCartney's new album, McCartney 3.
Yeah.
I thought that was really cool. I'm a big fan of this guy, Mark Orton, who used to play in Tin Hat Trio. And he, that's an instrumental group that's amazing. And he just put out another film score that I really like a lot. And I've also been lately on a kick getting back into kind of everything Ben Folds. I just really like Ben Folds 5. I've been listening to some of their live stuff and stuff he's done. It's just so creative. He's leaning way into creativity in the sense that he just has, I think, a new podcast that's all about, he just interviews other creative people, not just musicians, and they talk creativity. And so he's an inspiration to me for sure.
I think for me, I'm a big fan of Audrey Assad. Do you know her?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
I just really appreciate the depth and simplicity, as well as just the, like, her level of excellence of performance, both her singing voice and her piano playing, are so helpful to me. That's a weird thing like adjective to use, but her music is so helpful. I read for it really, really often. As far as other, I don't know if you want to say sacred music or music written for the church, I guess. I really like The Porter's Gate, and I really like Common Hymnal quite a bit. Beyond that, man, I love U2. I love Coldplay. Like, I realize it's not a cool answer, but like Coldplay's newest record, Everyday Life, is really incredible.
It's
and there's
terrific.
So much variety on
yes.
it.
Yes.
And it's so good. There's so much like spirit, like creeping out all the edges of all those songs. Meanwhile, they're just going in all these different musical directions, and it feels very like, very worldly, very global in a way that I really loved. And then one of my favorite artists is this singer songwriter from the Northeast states named Stephen Kellogg, who's just this like earnest as could be family man, just really great, really great songwriter. I just believe him. He's one of those guys that when he sings, I just believe him, and I respect something about him, which I find hard to do myself. Like, I'm always trying to run away from my own gentleness or my own squishiness. I'd always like to be a little bit cooler. I'd like to have like one or two more masks on than I do. I'd like to be a little bit more inscrutable than I am. I mean, those are like my values are being, you know, vulnerable and being known and being honest and all that. But when it comes down to it, I wish I had like more protection. I wish I had like a cooler persona sort of. And yet what I love and respect about Stephen Kellogg is there's none of that. It's the most genuine, like, this is my heart kind of guy. Like, this is my heart and I own it and I love it. So I don't need you to like tell me that you like it or that it's okay. This is just who I am. And this is, now I'm singing some songs about my wife and my four daughters, you know?
Yeah.
Like, that's the kind of dude that he is. And there's something about that genuineness, that earnestness that I like, even though I kind of run away from it for some strange reason in my life.
It's, yeah, that's a very vulnerable place. 'Cause you're writing a song that could be out there, you know, forever, about something that could be very, you know, personal to you. And so that's a special type of songwriting. And Ryan, I totally agree on Ben Folds. I've been listening to picking up on him again lately, and just what a great narrative storyteller when it comes to songwriting. He just has this crazy gift. Like, my favorite songs that he writes are ones that are where he's telling usually a sad story, but like there's always some sort of kind of narrative arc happening. But yeah, I'm gonna have to check out the Stephen Kellogg. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I would say, like, if you guys haven't listened to him, the band Manchester Orchestra has been one of my favorites for a while. They just dropped a new album last week. And from a lyrical standpoint, that dude, I think his name's Andy Huff, I think, is a lead singer. Just kills me every time they come out with something new lyrically. It's like poetry.
Oh, okay. Our buddy Joe is always telling us to listen to Manchester Orchestra, and I've never really given him like my full attention yet. So you've just validated Joe Sorensen in Iowa right now. He's got to be doing some fist bumps right now. So the new one is called like a Million Masks of God or something.
Yeah,
something like that.
Yeah, it's super good. The one before that too, I haven't decided yet. I've been listening to the new one on repeat for the past several days. But the album they dropped before that, what is it? A Black Mile from the Surface is, I think, for my money, one of the best complete albums from start to finish. Like, you know, you guys have been in the scene for a long time, so you know kind of the space we're in now, where it's very much instant gratification. Everybody's just putting out singles now, and there's not a whole lot of like complete albums, it seems like, anymore, from start to finish. And this thing is just, it's cohesive. There's a lot of variants in it, but it all makes sense. It flows together really well. Lyrically, it's just incredible. I think the last song on it, I think it's the last track, one of the last tracks called The Silence, is just one of my favorite songs ever. It's sad, but it's musically, it's big, it's beautiful. It's just, yeah, it's something else. That album's phenomenal.
I definitely will check that out. I love albums that are albums that tell a story, that have a, you know, themes and that are complete. That's something that we really wanted. It was really important to me, I guess I would say, for Under the Leaves, this record that we just put out. Like, the songs, some of them make reference to other songs on the record, or complete ideas that were little seeds that were planted earlier in the record will sort of sprout and grow as the record, you know, goes on. And to me, that's just a rewarding experience. If you sit down and listen, and you kind of, there's kind of a fun, cool factor of just listening and being like, whoa, I love this. This song is dealing with making peace with the regret that like track number four talked about. Like, he was, you know, track number four was all about, I didn't have the chance because I didn't take the chance. And here we are at the end of the record, and it's like making peace with that somehow. Wow, I didn't expect that would happen, you know. But I love that kind of internal storytelling.
My favorite connection that you have on the record is actually Cameron references one of our very first songs that we ever did as a band, a song called Gardens in the Graves, which was an early favorite song of ours, probably one of our most popular early songs, and still a crowd favorite. And on our song Morning Breaking, you want to say that verse, Cameron, that's on Morning Breaking, that you call back to that? Through the fields and through the forest?
I think it's right before then. Let's see. I might have to just wide awake, the morning breaking, night I'm shaking off. My eyes are wider than they've been in months. I dream the weight of my mistakes have fallen from my hands, like scattered seeds behind me as I ran. And all the tears I thought were wasted, watered down below, till a garden from the grave began to grow. Now through the field and through the forest, on to unknown lands, I learned to love the traveler as I am.
Yeah, I thought that was really beautiful. And what's really neat is to hear Cameron express that, like, I've heard him talk about that song and say, in a way, all this time he didn't know exactly what Gardens in the Graves, the old song of ours, was about. And it like, there was this, here, you know, 18 years after he wrote that song, or 20 years after he wrote that song, whatever, it's sort of, I guess we're talking long game again here.
Right. Well, it was originally inspired by my favorite band in high school was the Gin Blossoms. They're also from Arizona.
Yeah.
They had Hey Jealousy and Found Out About You and Allison Road Until I Hear It From You. And their principal songwriter was this guy named Doug Hopkins, and just really prolific. And he wrote the song that opened their big album. And it was like, I drink enough of anything. What's it? So he goes, the last horizons I can see are filled with bars and factories, and in them all we fight to stay awake. So I drink enough of anything to make this world look new again. I'm drunk gardens and lives. And this song is so catchy and beautiful and hauntingly upbeat in this really bittersweet way. But there was just this sense of like the singer feeling really trapped. Like he looks around and all he sees are bars and factories and nothing good about this place. And he looks at his relationship and he can't see anything good about this place. So he's like, I drink enough of anything to make this girl look new again. You know, I'm drunk in the gardens and the graves. And what's so difficult about that is that a couple years after writing that, he ended up taking his own life. So their principal songwriter, the Gin Blossoms principal songwriter, killed himself right as they were really, you know, rising to prominence. And it's just, I think that stuck in my mind because that's like, well, you kind of know escapism can only take you so far, alcoholism can only take you so far. That was the natural end result of that. But there also, it was something in his seeing that was stuck. It was like, I can't make sense or find beauty in any of this. I mean, the beauty he found, I guess, was in the songs, the melodies that he wrote. There was a lot of gorgeous melodies and harmonies happening in there. But it's that he couldn't find a way to make peace with those parts of the city that he was from, or make peace with his family, or make peace with the relationships. And that's like the thing I feel like that, you know, I wrote those long time ago for ours, the Gardens in the Graves, kind of responding to that and being like, well, we need to learn to like go out of the world, have like be a different kind of person, a more hopeful person in the world, but still didn't really know what that idea Gardens in the Graves meant until now. And that's what it means on this record on Morning Breaking, is that we have to find a way to look at all the mistakes, all the good parts, and see all of them as seeds that have been filling the soil, and the very pain, the tears that we would do anything to avoid are the very thing that waters the soil, you know, and it ends up growing this garden behind us if we let it, you know. It's sort of trying to find a way to see the beauty that comes out of all of these, all this pain, all these mistakes, everything that we would rather avoid.
Oh, man. Well, guys, I don't know that there's a better way to end it than on that note. So before I let you guys go, tell folks where they can stay up on top of what you guys are up to, get a copy of the new record, and all that good stuff.
Yeah, well, just ryanhood.com. The band is Ryan Hood. It's like Robin Hood, but Ryan Hood, one word. And yeah, go on, you know, jump on there and get it from there. One thing that's actually really special about the new record is we made a companion book with it that is full of expanded artwork, but also essays and stories behind all of the songs. So you know, if you like a podcast and like going deep, you would probably like to put on the record and go deep and read the stories and thoughts behind everything on it. So that's probably one of my favorite elements of this. So yeah, you can get that there. It'll link you to our Bandcamp where you can get the music, and you can stream it on Spotify or any of those places, and find us on all the socials and on Patreon and all that stuff.
Yeah. I just want to add, if I could, there too, John, like how much appreciation I have for what you and Adam started with this podcast and what you're carrying on, because it strikes me that that you're doing this thing I think I heard first from Richard Rohr, which is like, it's something like transcend and include, like question and grow. But I always get the sense when I listen to this podcast that you're never shaming earlier thoughts. You're never sort of like disowning places that you've come from or writers that were helpful to you when you were younger, or sort of going, oh, well, that's the old thing. And, you know, there's a sense in which it seems to me that you're including those ideas as you grow. And there's something that's really gentle and really grace-filled about that. So I didn't want to end this podcast without telling you how grateful I am for what you guys, for the approach that you guys have to growing in all these ways, you know?
Oh, thank you. That means a lot to have you say that, because that was a very intentional approach when Adam and I first started, and has continued to be an important component of this podcast, especially as there's a lot of new content out there that fits into this kind of niche. And I don't know that all of it's necessarily healthy, from the respect that a lot of it comes from a place of anger and resentment from that sort of upbringing. And I think, you know, I think there's a way, like you said, I think Rohr, if he's taught us anything, it's, you know, like you said, to transcend and include. And I think appreciate the roots and the structure that you received in your younger years, and building off of that, as opposed to, you know, I guess taking cheap shots at it. I think that's easy to do, and it's easy to stay in that place of anger and resentment, but I don't know that you can stay there, and I don't know that you should stay there. And so I really appreciate you saying that. So, yeah. Well, thanks again, guys.
You're welcome. It makes me think of it.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
It's the
delay. Please, yeah.
No. Yeah, I know. This is just this kind of odd audio lag. You don't even have to include this. It just makes me think of that desert island story that Peter Rollins tells.
Yes.
Do you know that one?
Yeah.
Like that thing that you're like, instead of always disowning the thing that came before, you just like, it's all a part of what got you here, what got you to be the person that you are now, you know?
Yeah, 100%. Absolutely. I love that. Yeah. Pete's great. And you, what you said earlier kind of made me think of him when he talks about, you know, where we pay attention more to the symptoms, you know, than we do to the underlying, you know, root cause of what's causing those symptoms to manifest. You know, there's a lot of good folks out there like Pete and like Rohr and a lot of those other folks who are just doing, you know, Jacqueline Bussey, Diana Butler Bass, doing really great work, while I think still maintaining this level of humility and grace for, you know, where we came from.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for having us. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks so much, guys, for coming on. We're definitely gonna we'll feature some of the songs that we talked about. Hopefully, if I do a good enough job of editing, it'll be kind of tucked in there throughout the discussion. But can't recommend enough. The new album is absolutely gorgeous. Great job to the both of you, from the music to the production quality to the lyrics. It's just a beautiful album that I think people are gonna enjoy. So go out and get it. Go support the guys. And guys, thanks again for coming on. This is really fun.
It was a pleasure, John. Thank you.
The world is changing. You feel it spinning faster. I heard you saying we're heading for disaster in the end. Feels like we're caving in. The world is changing. There might not be enough in. We're all afraid things are blowing up and someone is to blame. But you can name some names, lock them all away, and drive away the hate by hating. Try to smash that thing down, try to
to stamp that thing out. Try to grab it all and pound it down to a thousand pieces. Don't be afraid, though the earth should give way. Show me all your faith and all the ways you love. The faces of the ones who disagree. Changing, it's not that different really. We do the same things we did for centuries, and we get scared. We point over there. I think it's strange how we're never good at knowing the moment we change to be the same as what we fight against. Just feels like self-defense. So we try again. We drive away the hate by hating. Try to smash that thing down. Try to stamp that thing out. Try to grab it all and pound it down to a thousand pieces. Don't be afraid, though the earth should give way. Just show me all your faith and all the ways you love. The faces of the ones who disagree. Take right, take left, take blue, take red. Take heart, take head, take sharks, take jets. Take the comment section from the last election. Take the things we write, take our misdirection. Take the fear that makes us want to drive them out and act the same as what we're mad about. Take the Inquisition, think of prohibition. Shock and awe against your real law. Take crusades and hate and mobs and frenzies. Screws and clicks, the crucifixion, ethnic cleansing. And it isn't only all about the pain and hurt. Also that it never really seems to work. Cause the heavier the hand that holds and squeezes, the more you break the thing into a million pieces. And every little spore is gonna grow again. You could call that hell, you could call that sin. But the only revolution is the one within. Till we throw ourselves into the light, we will never win the fight. That thing down, never stamp that thing out, never grab it all and pound it down in a thousand pieces. So don't be afraid, though the earth should give way. Show me all your faith and all the ways you love. Try to smash that thing down, try to stamp that thing out, try to grab it all and pound it down to a thousand pieces. So don't be afraid, no, don't be afraid. Just show me all your faith and all the ways you love. The faces of the ones who disagree.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.